It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest has lots of recipes to help us make dinner out of snacks. First, Sunday marks both Father's Day and Juneteenth, now a federal holiday that commemorates the freeing of enslaved African Americans and celebrates Black culture and community. So it was a great time for our next guest to release a new book about her own 96-year-old father, a Black man born and raised in rural Louisiana in the Jim Crow era. We'll find out how he lived, as our guest writes, often oppressed, never defeated, and share some of the wisdom and lessons he passed down to her. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you collected the story of your dad or your grandfather? What lessons have you learned from them? Is there something you'd like to share with us? If you're a dad yourself, what are you trying to pass on to your own kids? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Nita Whitaker is an award-winning actress and singer, as well as a former intensive care unit nurse and former Miss Louisiana. Her latest book is called When Your Hand is in the Lion's Mouth, The Life and Wisdom of a Man Named Green. Nita, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob. I'm excited to be here with you.
I've heard a couple times lately on the show that a very common regret people have is that they didn't collect, they didn't hear the stories of their parents and grandparents. What is it that led you to start off on this project and collect your dad's story?
Well, my dad is an innate teacher. Even when he's not doing anything in particular, there's always some way, by example or just something he says, that you catch something. And he would say these phrases that I would catch over the years. So I said, Dad, I want to get some of these stories down, because he is the last living of his entire family. There were 19 children, and he is the second to the youngest, but his eldest brother passed away in 2020. So he is the last living one. And I knew that I wanted to save these stories because I've repeated them. I've repeated some of these lessons to my friends and family when something comes up. And I say, you know, my dad says. So I thought it would be prudent of me to collect them and have them here for him as an homage, and paying homage to not a perfect man, but a great man, a great dad, so that my children and my grandchildren and people can get to know some of this sage homespun wisdom of a great father.
Well, I feel honored to have met Green Whitaker through your book. But one thing I wondered reading the book is, what did he say when you told him you wanted to write a book about him?
He is so easy. He's one of those, still has this childlike innocence. He said, oh boy. He said, that'll be great. I said, okay, Daddy, I'm going to do it. It was a process to do it, because in the process of writing, as you know, you're living. There are things that I was juggling around, trying to write a chapter and, you know, remodeling a kitchen or going to work for 2 months across the country. And but I just kept going. And I knew that I would get here. And I think it arrived at the right time, because I was pushing myself for some other dates, but I think everything happens in a divine time. And I think this is the perfect time for it to come out. He is still so cognitively together, and he's able-bodied. He's able to take care of himself. And it's just a blessing to have him and to still be able to pick up the phone and call him and say, hey, Dad, what do you think about? Or, hey, Dad, tell me that story about. And he just recalls it. He's just all right there. It's such a gift. He is such a gift.
One of the things you interviewed him about was his life as a teenager. Now we're in rural Louisiana. He's picking cotton for uncertain amounts of money. Can you share some of what you learned about that era and his life in it?
Well, they were a very large family, so they were a big force in the Holly community where he grew up. And at 10, when they were forced to move and sell their home and their oil came in on their property. They moved to a sharecropping farm owned by the Frierson family. It's still in existence, and still they still produce cotton crop today. but he learned a lot. They were all in there doing together. Most of the people in their community did this kind of work. It was the work you did. It was what was in front of you, so you did it. Before they became sharecroppers, they were completely self-sufficient and independent, had their own cotton, their own fruit, vegetables that they took care of themselves, and then they became sort of dependent on this system that they were forced into. But I think that the lesson that he took away from all of that was a great work ethic. And my grandfather, who I never met, but my father speaks of him with such love and adoration, as I speak about my dad, he said, people would say to their dad, Isaac Whitaker, why do you make those boys work so hard? And he said, it's because they have to know how to work on any job. I'm not going to be around always, but I want them to know how to do whatever is put in front of them. So he made sure they were they were completing tasks, they were doing everything to the best of their ability, that they were proud of the work, even the cotton picking that they were doing. So sometimes there was never information given about what the seed cost. So the landowner could discriminately or indiscriminately just pick a number to give you. One year, I think if you may have read it, he and his brother had worked about, had baled about 12, had harvested about 12 to 13 bales of cotton, which should have been about $1,000. But because they weren't given any information about what the seed cost, and the guy goes into the farmer and, well, you know, I had to pay for this, and I had to pay for that. But if the numbers changed, they were never given the information. So they were totally reliant on whatever that person said it was. That when their dad was alive, he could do math in his head and he would always correct them. And they knew that about Isaac Whitaker. But not having the information, my dad and his brother could have figured it out. They just weren't given the information. So they were given subservient wages as well. So when he finally, the last time he picked cotton, I think he was 21, he was at a different farm of a gentleman who they had heard was very fair. And he got this first check for $1,200 for the same amount of land, the 10 acres or so. And he was like, wow. But he was done. That was the last time he said he moved on to other work, and he never looked back.
We're talking to Nita Whitaker about her new book, When Your Hand is in the Lion's Mouth, The Life and Wisdom of a Man Named Green, a memoir of her father. You could join in if you've collected a story like this in your own family at 800-642-1234, or maybe a lesson you learned from your dad getting ready for a Father's Day. Now, I mentioned that phrase you wrote about your dad, often oppressed, never defeated in his life. And this seems like this is one of the biggest lessons that you take and share from your dad, Green. Can you talk about that?
Well, he was born into the Jim Crow era. He was born in 1926, and America was about to plunge into the Great Depression. There was, you know, bigoted and targeted racial violence. There was lynching. There was all of these things. But for a little while, they were cocooned in this beautiful bubble, rural bubble in Holly, Louisiana. And even though the world around them, and even when they were moved down to pick cotton on the Frierson plantation, they learned how to exist in the system that was meant to keep them oppressed. But there was a resilience within the family unit, resilience within that beautiful big family, that they had each other, they had their faith, and they never felt like they were less than. They were respected people in the community. They did good work. They were honorable people. And that good name carried them further. My father came out of that cotton field, and he's traveled all over the world. He was the number one insurance agent in Louisiana for about 25 years in his region. He just wanted more. He wanted his part of the American dream, and he believed it came through work. And that work got him to the place where he was able to co-create a beautiful family and a home life that was that filled his heart, and it surely blessed all of his children.
Now, you lost your mom too early, and I was sorry to read that. Can you talk about how Green, your dad, took that dual role on?
Well, my dad is exceptional in so many ways, and having to take up that mantle of dad and then try to fill in some of the spaces that mom left was quite daunting. He just knew that it was his job to keep the family a family. And so he did. He was present for everything. He was, he showed up. He made sure we had our family gatherings, Christmas, and all the things that we did together. He just was available. And he was there for all of us. He let us continue to grow. He, I'm sure, had his own way of grieving. We'd grieve together and separately, but he was able to keep us a united front. And we have always been close, but we just became closer after we lost mommy. And I'm so grateful for a father like that who didn't fall apart, because he knew he still was the shepherd of this flock. And he kept us going. And I love him forever for that.
We're talking to singer, actress, and author Nita Whitaker about her new memoir of her father. It's called When Your Hand is in the Lion's Mouth, The Life and Wisdom of a Man Named Green. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with singer, actress, and author Nita Whitaker. We're talking about her father and life lessons she learned from him just ahead of Father's Day and Juneteenth, which both fall on Sunday this weekend. Nita's new book, also out this weekend, is a memoir about her father called When Your Hand is in the Lion's Mouth, The Life and Wisdom of a Man Named Green. Nita, we talked just a few moments ago about how your dad really helped you get through tough times. He was also there for you and your biggest fan as you started to develop this career in music and acting. Can you talk about your dad as your fan?
Well, he just, everything that I did, my dad showed up for. If I had two lines in a play, he was right there. And then when I moved to California and I was trying to start in this big wide world of show business outside of the comfort zone of Louisiana, he was just the person that I call, because he knows people. He understands human behavior. So he was able to, I said, Daddy, this. I would call him about situations, and he would just have just the right sage advice to give me to kind of help me understand a situation that I may have found myself in, or to calm me down. So he was with me all the way. So when I got the Star Search, and it took me a few tries to get there, I met Sam Harris, who you may remember from Star Search. I did a play with him, a musical, and he got me my fifth audition, which is when I finally got on the show. Thank you, Sam. And my dad was in the audience when I was singing for the final, and the song that I chose was Piece of Sky from Yentl, a Barbra Streisand song from her movie Yentl. And the last line of it is, Papa, watch me fly. And the whole song, for me, I sang to him. Because everything in my life that I've been able to accomplish, I really know and believe is because of having a great foundation of a profound fatherly love. We need our moms, too. That's not to negate anything that our beautiful mothers give us, but because we are in the season of celebrating fathers, and this certainly is, for me, a celebration and homage to my father, who is not a perfect man, but he's a really good man. He's a beautiful being who, like I say in the book, he embodies the best of us. And he was just there every step of the way. When I didn't have a good performance, I'd call my dad, and he would, because he had been a singer, and he was like, well, honey, you know, he had some advice for that, which is in the book. I want you to read it. He just knew what to say to get me through to the other side of some challenge or whatever that I was going through. So he has been my steady counselor. And my incredible, just incredible resource.
You share a lot of the wisdom that he has given you over the years. Some of it you kind of point organized into four foundations, including this one: love will always win. What did you learn from Green, from your dad, about the ways that love can win in the end?
He lived that. He always led with kindness and love. And he would say to us, girls, I want you to do everything in love and excellence, love and excellence. And I think that he felt if you approach things from the viewpoint of loving instead of the viewpoint of someone is after me, or just approach it with love, you can turn that situation around. I saw him do it time and time again when there was tempers flaring, and my father would come in with just a calm word and a loving word that would just diffuse the situation. There was so many times when I've seen him in action doing this, and that's the thing that's really great about my dad, is that he was the example. He just didn't say it. He lived it. He modeled it. He showed it. And it wasn't something he was doing like, I'm going to show you how to do this. It was innate for him. And he led with love. When you meet him, and he's one of those kind people, you know right away who he is, because there's no layer. It's just love. He meets you with love. So I witnessed that. I got to see my father as a living example of that. So of course that spilled over to us and became a part of our personalities and a part of how we approach life and people.
And there was something, this is a running theme for a while in his life. There's something in his bearing, his demeanor, where people kept thinking he was a preacher of some sort. He wasn't, but people would look at him and read, oh, this guy's a preacher.
Oh, still to this day, I mean, people say, Mr. Green, are you were you called? There's a story where we were sitting in a restaurant, and this lady, and this was the time where people were not eating together, black and white people were not eating together. And we were sitting, and we always went for dinner on Sundays, because my dad said to my mom, you're not cooking today. So that would be a big treat for the whole family. And this lady walks over to my dad, and he's like, oh gosh, what did I do? What did I say? And she walks over and she puts her hand on his shoulder. And she said, I've traveled from Florida to here, and I don't see a lot of people like you. Have you been called? And he said, I haven't heard anything. But so many times during his life, he has a carriage that's very like a Southern statesman. And he always has this this graciousness about him. And he is a man of great faith. So I think all those things combined, and I think, and sometimes it has given him, it's gotten him out of a couple scrapes, which is a good thing. But I think there was something in him that people could see that was faith filled. And the question would always come, but I think it's a good thing.
Talking to Nita Whitaker, singer, actress, author of the new book, When Your Hand is in the Lion's Mouth, The Life and Wisdom of a Man Named Green. Nita, you're a parent yourself. What kind of specific things did you try to, you know, model yourself on from your dad?
Well, there were two in particular. One of them that my dad modeled for me was finding a way. My brother was born with special needs. He had a physical handicap, and my mom and dad had to leave him in New Orleans at Shriners Hospital for a special surgery. And they traveled for 6 months every weekend, 6 hours one way, 6 hours back, to visit with him every single weekend. They wanted to give him the best opportunity to have the best start to his life that they could, even if it meant being separated from him for a time. They mainstreamed him. They did all the things that were not normally done when my brother was small. They just said, no, he's going to be right here with us. He's going to do everything that we do. They found a way. So I use that word, that mantra, find a way, when I'm trying to figure out my way through a situation, or find a way to make it work, find a way to get through it. And the other one that I love is go all the way. Dad was shaving, which is my dad still shaves every morning. It's part of his morning ritual. And this particular morning when I was in college, my mother had passed, and I was sitting on the countertop in between the two sinks, and he was shaving, and he was just chatted like we normally did. And he just looked up and said, I'm going to need you to go all the way. And that statement, he did, when I saw him living that, when I was not considering going for Miss Louisiana for the fourth time, because I thought it wasn't going to happen. I thought they weren't going to allow me to win. My dad said, go all the way. I remembered him in that cotton field having to pick cotton in that Louisiana humid heat, and doing it day after day. And I thought, how can I not go all the way? How can I not give it my best? You know, how can I not give everything that I do 150%? Because my dad did that. So that means I can do it, because it's in me too. So those two things have informed everything in my life.
Nita, I think probably all of us have someone, maybe it's a parent or grandparent or an elder in our community that we wish we knew more about, even if we're not going to end up writing a book about it. Can you give us some encouragement on how to get started with something like that?
Well, I think just, you know, we have iPhones. We have places that we can record their voices, because you want to have their voices. Like I said, my dad is the last living of his family of 19. And when it is his time, I wanted to be sure that I had not just this book, but his voice, because that portal will be closed to those stories. My great-grandmother lived to be 104, my maternal great-grandmother. Wow. And I was too young to have the presence of mind to ask her questions about her life, that she could thread a needle at 100 years old. I didn't have the presence of mind because I was young and I wished I'd taken down more of her stories. I do have some of my mom's siblings that are still alive and they can give me more information, but my dad is the last portal into his family's experience. So I really wanted to, I want to encourage people to write them down. If it's just for the family, record them on your cell phones and get those stories before you aren't able to get them anymore.
In just our last few moments, you were obviously really close to your dad before you started this book. Do you feel like in some ways you discovered new things that brought you closer together?
I guess so. We've always been very close. He and I have a special bond. We're the singers of the family, even though everybody sings, but he and I probably did it more publicly and me more so than dad. But we've just always had a special bond, and I think I've grown to appreciate his journey even more because I've chronicled it a little bit in the book, not every aspect of it, but some moments of it and how his life informed my life and how I was able to reach back and get some knowledge from him and give it to my children and have him give some up to my children. I do think it just made me appreciate and adore him even more.
A great place to leave it. Nita, thanks so much for sharing Green Story with us.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Nita Whitaker is a singer, actress, and author. We talked to her about his latest book out this weekend, a memoir about her dad. It's called When Your Hand is in the Lion's Mouth, The Life and Wisdom of a Man Named Green. Coming up after the news, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. We're making snacks for dinner. We'll share recipes for delicious dips, crunchy crisps, and savory salads. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the latest news on the war in Ukraine and the aid being sent to Ukraine from Western countries as European leaders announced today their support of the country joining the European Union. Now, do you ever come home after a long day and not really feel like making, you know, a full-on dinner, entree plus sides? Sometimes you want to just grab some favorite snacks and have an informal meal, maybe with some sweet and salty, crunchy and chewy. It's Food Friday, and our guest today says that is just fine. He encourages it. He wrote a whole book on how to do it even better. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite snack you like to eat for dinner? Do you like having that dinner of a bunch of little stuff instead of that big thing and then some side dishes along the way? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lucas Vulgar is a writer and editor. His new cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. Lucas, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Well, I'll say up front, I'm so on board with this. I do this sort of snacks for dinner sometimes, and I'm like, why don't I do this more often? Then I forget about it. So your book's a new inspiration. What was your inspiration? There was one particular meal that got you on this theme.
Yeah, you know, I feel like I'd probably, it's kind of an intuitive way to eat, but there's this one meal that sort of calcified it in my mind. I was traveling, I was in Los Angeles, I visited a family friend. She had invited me over for lunch. This is something that had been planned a ways in advance. And when we got there, there were sort of like no signs of any meal preparation happening, which, you know, I'm kind of a a planner, and so that always worries me and stresses me out. But then over a matter of like 5 or 10 minutes, she just kind of pulled together this beautiful meal. She had picked up these dips from her farmer's market. She had these really delicious carrots. She threw out a wedge of cheese, a bowl of crackers, and it was all these like little things that were out on the table. And it just ended up becoming this incredibly memorable meal for myself and my husband, Vincent. And then as the pandemic wore on, it became a very functional way to eat because we didn't want to wash any dishes. Tortilla chip became a spoon. The tub of hummus became a serving bowl. We sort of like ate with our hands as much as we could because we were so tired of washing dishes. And so that's sort of where the book journey took me. And now I just find it to be an incredibly fun way to entertain with my friends and just putting all the food out on the table. And it's so functional for people with dietary restrictions. You can get vegetables in there in so many different ways. It's just been, it doesn't have to be this sort of sad, passive way to eat. That you can do it with intention. You can do it with a lot of fun flavors and great seasonal produce as well.
And I love this style of cooking because I sometimes think, oh, if I'm doing it this way, I need 5 or 6 different things. So that means I have to make 5 or 6 different things. But as you just pointed out, there can be a hybrid. The dip you bought at the market or local store or whatever, maybe something you prepared yourself that day, maybe something you made the night before. You can really do a lot of different workflow here.
Yeah, absolutely. That was something that was kind of important to make clear when I was writing the book is, no, this does not mean that you have to make 7, 8 different little, you know, things and then serve little, you know, portions of them. But instead, you can sort of mix and match. And I think that something that makes a snacks for dinner meal really shine is when you can source sort of carefully. So like, I love visiting farmers markets whenever I travel, and I find constantly that, you know, while certainly this is one of the best places to get good produce, it's also an incredible place to find locally made cheeses. There's like a wonderful like Lebanese purveyor at my farmers market where you can get these incredible little salads, breads, crackers. I mean, if you could just pick up a few things from that or a specialty store in your neighborhood, you're going to have some really, really nice food, and you won't have to make all of it yourself.
Lucas Vulgar is with us on this week's edition of Food Friday. His newest cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you like to eat this way? Do you like to entertain this way? A bunch of little stuff instead of that big fancy centerpiece in the meal. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lucas, you have kind of a philosophy of putting these things together, and you divide the cookbook this way of having, you know, different kinds of dishes like crispy and crunchy or tangy and juicy. Can you run us through those categories and why you like to have that contrast?
Sure. The way I thought to organize this book was primarily by trait, thinking that if you can satisfy these textural components, then it's going to sort of like naturally it naturally becomes sort of like a really nicely balanced and varied meal. My first chapter in the book is crispy crunchy, and that's little like snack mixes and those types of things that, you know, you might even think of them as a garnish in a traditional meal, but it can be so much fun to have a little bowl of Chex Mix or even like a sort of thoughtfully and interestingly seasoned bowl of popcorn at the table. And then there's tangy juicy, and those end up being like pickles and like marinated vegetables, which just bring a pop of color and brings a, you know, sort of a hit of sweetness and acid. And the nice thing about these things too is that they allow you to sort of like customize your bite. So the crunchy things can be sprinkled over a little bit of soup, and the pickles can, you can garnish a little like, you know, dip on a cracker with a little pickle. There's also in there, I have a whole section of, you know, crackers and breads, and I call that sturdy supports because you're going to need something to carry that dip. I also put in a chapter of soups and salads, and the way that I sort of fashion those as being snack friendly is the salads, I call them spoon salads. And the thinking behind them is that the vegetables are either sort of like finely shaved or grated, and then the salads are very like nutritionally dense. So one salad I'm thinking of in particular is a carrot, lentil, and date salad that's then flavored with a bunch of fresh dill. And so just a few spoonfuls of this, it delivers a bunch of flavor. And then also it's just, as I said, it's really nutritionally dense. So a small amount goes a long way on the snacks plate.
You shared a few recipes with us, including that lentils, carrots, and dates with dill salad. That is up at WPR.org/Food Friday for anyone who wants to check it out this weekend. Let's go to a caller at 800-642-1234. Susie is with us in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. I have a little sister who is a grandma extraordinaire, and when her kids were little, her grandchildren were little, she would give each of them a skewer, you know, like for at supper time. And she would have all kinds of stuff, really good, you know, fruits and vegetables and cheeses. And, you know, she could even have a couple of hot dogs in there. It didn't, you know, didn't matter. And said, you can only eat what you can skewer. And the kids would have a ball. And they ate so well. You know, the parents would say, oh, no, they'll never eat that stuff. They'll never eat that kind of thing. And they did. And they ate everything. And they didn't know it, but they ended up loving that kind of food, and they still eat like that. Yeah, I mean, not necessarily with the skewer, but they eat, you know, healthy food.
Now, wait a minute, Susie. Were you jealous of the skewers? Did you have to get a skewer, too?
I was very jealous because I only heard about it. It was just when she was with her grandkids.
Susie, yeah. Thank you so much for sharing that. A really little presentation thing there. Lucas made a lot of difference and got kids to eat stuff they wouldn't eat ordinarily.
Yeah, I love that. I love the idea for the skewers. I definitely want to try that out. I mean, one of the things I wanted to mention is one of the sort of fixtures of my snacky dinners is a big plate of crudité. And I like to actually spend some time on it, you know, cutting the vegetables into like, you know, shapes that are going to be really friendly for like scooping up a dip or, you know, so. And I guess just what I'm trying to say is like putting some intention into those vegetables and getting really fresh, delicious ones. And when I do this and when I'm eating like with my nieces and with my friends' kids, they are so excited to eat the vegetables when they look really cool. So I'm actually not surprised that those kids were, you know, the whole skewer meal went over well with them, because that's kind of been my experience with this as well.
Thanks, Susie, for that call at 800-642-1234. You just mentioned dips, which can be a great part of these meals. Store-bought or made at home. You shared a recipe with us. We've got it at WPR.org/Food Friday, a toasted walnut and feta dip. You call it the perfect excuse to eat a whole block of cheese in one sitting. We don't have any problem doing that in Wisconsin, I'll tell you. But tell us about this toasted walnut and feta dip.
Sure. This is a very simple dip. It's you're going to toast a good handful of walnuts, and I like to toast them quite well. That brings out as much of the flavor as possible. And then it's simply blended with feta cheese. I think it's important to use a brine feta that it comes in the brine, because that's gonna be more moist and creamy. But if you don't have that, I've got some workarounds there where you can just add a little bit of milk. But the walnuts and the feta go into your food processor and it's blended until it's creamy. And then I make a little garnish with some leftover toasted walnuts, and that goes on top. But really, that's it. It's all of my dips. I try to make them as simple as possible, because I think it's kind of fun to just whip up a dip if you have friends coming over, and it only takes a couple minutes.
We're talking to writer and editor Lucas Vulgar about his new cookbook. It's called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite snack you like to make and eat as a snack, or make it part of your meal? Do you like eating like this? I love it. Hey, you know what? It just hits me. This reminds me of something we got here in Wisconsin at the supper club. My favorite thing at the supper club, the relish tray. Do you have a favorite relish tray, a favorite thing to have on it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. Now we pick up our Food Friday talk with Lucas Vulgar. He's the author of the new cookbook, Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite dip, a go-to recipe to share? What is the best food to dip in your dips? I hope you don't double dip. Do you like to make meals, as I do, out of little things, a bunch of little stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Sue is with us in Fish Creek. Sue, hi.
Hi, what a fun show. One of our favorite things is left overnight, but it's not left overnight from one night. It's left overnight from three or four nights, so that you have a little bit of everything. And I'm really interested in reading your guest's book so I can do extra little things to tie all that together.
Oh, interesting, Sue. Thanks a lot. Yeah, if we want to theme our leftovers into our snack meal, Lucas, any thoughts?
Yeah, I love that you bring that up, Sue, because one of the things that appeals to me about this is how resourceful this style of eating is. I find with leftovers, if you only have a little bit of something left over, it's, you know, you can just kind of eat it there at the fridge and make it go away. But if in a snacks for dinner spread, that small amount of leftovers can actually go a long way because everybody only needs a little bit.
Excellent, Sue. Hope that helps. Thanks for joining us at 800-642-1234. We've checked out a couple recipes online at WPR.org/foodfriday. Here's a one more sriracha snack mix with puffed rice and peanuts. Now, I hear the sriracha folks are having some supply trouble with some key peppers, but assuming we can get our hands on sriracha or something like it, tell us about this kind of zippy snack mix.
Yes, for sure. And you can use other types of sriracha, which are available here. I know that there's a bunch of different alternatives at the grocery store, which would work great in this dip. But anyway, this is another very simple recipe. You're going to toast some puffed rice or any kind of puffed grain that you like with some almonds and peanuts. It's a little bit spicy mix. It dries out really nicely so that it's really crispy and crunchy. It would be a beautiful thing to use as a garnish on some kind of soup or throw into some kind of salad. But to be honest, it never really lasts that long for me. I find it completely impossible to stop eating just as a snack mix.
Now, how about you mentioned you've got a chapter that includes some soups in it, which I don't always think of as part of a snacky meal. I don't know. What kind of soups fit well in this kind of combo?
Yeah, I like that you brought that up. I was I had thought the same thing at the outset as well. And then one of the things that struck me as I was working on this book was how, I mean, I have a smoothie habit. So I make a smoothie almost every morning and drink that. And I take it with me on the go. And I'm like, a smoothie is really just kind of like a sweet or a savory kind of cold soup. And like eating it on the go sort of in my mind refashions it a little bit as a snack. And so I kind of went in that direction. And so they aren't all cold soups. But they are, you know, the way a smoothie is sort of like has this concentrated amount of flavor, sort of similar to what I was saying about the salads before. Like the idea is that the soup is pretty intensely flavored and a small amount goes a long way. So I've got one soup in there that's a really delicious spinach soup that you saute some fennel down. So it has this wonderful sort of floral black note, back note. There's another, my favorite gazpacho recipe. It's a watermelon and tomato gazpacho that when everything is really ripe and juicy, that's the time to make this. And I'm really excited because we're starting to come upon that season right now. And what else? I think there might be one or two other soups in there, but they're well flavored so that you can serve them just in a small cup or a small bowl and add them to your snacks table.
We are having snacks for dinner on this week's edition of Food Friday. Lucas Vulgar is with us. His new cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can sample some of what he has to offer at WPR.org/Food Friday. He's shared three recipes for us. That snack mix we just talked about, a walnut and feta dip, and a lentil, carrot, and date with dill salad. Still time for you to join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite snacky dinner ideas. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. James writes there, I've been known to enjoy crackers and Laughing Cow cheese spread wedges for supper on occasion. Yet something as simple as crackers and spreadable cheese can be a great part of a snacky dinner or maybe a dinner all by themselves. Do you have favorite combos, Lucas?
I love that. We have the Laughing Cow cheese in our fridge as well. I mean, I think with cheese, what's kind of fun is like how easy it is to have a couple of them on hand. And, you know, you don't need to eat all... I know you can throw that whole block of feta into your dip, but you can sort of throw out a couple that complement each other. And it's a really easy way, especially for a vegetarian meal, to get a little bit more, some protein on the table and a little bit more creamy textures and stuff. So that meal that kicked this all off, there was a big wedge of like a dill flecked Havarte cheese, which I don't buy that often, but it just tasted so good in this meal. And we just cut off slabs and added them to our salad and with our crackers and stuff. But I also love, there's a recipe in there where you can take goat cheese or feta cheese and then just marinate it quickly in some olive oil and some fresh or dried herbs and spices and chilies. And that's a pretty easy way to sort of transform, you know, a roll of cheese or a wedge of cheese into something that is very different and then keeps well and just gets even more and more flavored over time in the fridge.
I want to key in on one chapter here where if you want kind of a highlight of a snacky meal, you've got a centerpiece-ish section. What can ascend a snack to that centerpiece quality?
Sure. I wanted to put this in here. The book is not really organized around the style of eating where you have this sort of like main dish or this protein in the center of the plate and then a couple sides around it. The idea is that everything kind of has their small bites and they all have equal billing. But these I think of as a little bit more centerpiece-ish because like when you put them out on the table, they might anchor the meal a little bit. So one of my favorite things in there, there's a feta and jam tart. And this is a feta-based filling, and then you sort of spoon your favorite tart jam over the top of the filling and then swirl it into the batter. So it's a really beautiful, really striking centerpiece type dish, but it's also very, very rich and flavorful. So sort of in keeping with those salads and the soups, a little bit of it goes a long way, and it's really easy to also eat out of hand.
One thing I wanted to ask you for my own personal edification, you mentioned spoon salads. I'm a big fan of making slaw. And when I'm doing something like this, I'll often do a carrot slaw and maybe a cabbage, you know, a basic coleslaw. And I've experimented with some things like celeriac slaw, which is the only food my kids actually spit out of their mouths when I made it. So I never did that again. But do you have ideas on other good vegetables that work for the slawification process?
Yeah, well, I think one of the vegetables that I think is a little bit underrated, and I know if your kids don't like celeriac or celery root, this might be a little bit of a challenge, but I love kohlrabi. And if anybody belongs to a CSA, they've probably gotten a kohlrabi in there and maybe they weren't sure what to do with it, but it's a kind of like a cross between like a turnip and maybe a potato. So it's like milder in flavor, but you can grate that or shave it really thinly and then toss it with any kind of dressing you would use on a slaw. And it would function in a really similar way. I also think that celery can be used in this way if you shave it really thinly. And then you could sort of go in a mayo-based dressing direction, but a nice sort of really acidic and bright vinaigrette complements that really well too.
All right. Now, a logistical question I've got for you. If we're entertaining for a group of X people, you know, if we're doing an entree, you know, I want to buy about, you know, this many pounds of protein, whatever it is for this many people. How do you figure out how much of the different things to make sure you've got the right amount of food and not, you know, overdo it?
I kind of think my rough formula is like for 2 to 3 people, you want like 3 to 4 items. I think if you're going to go all in and say it's a dinner party or say you're having 8 people over, kind of the more the better, and really don't hesitate to like lean into the store-bought, you know, option there. Just spend some time sourcing it, but and save your time in the kitchen, but then also invest in those. You know, it can be really fun to like make. I have a recipe for focaccia in there, like a big platter of like fresh made cut up focaccia is just like such an inviting thing. And then you can buy the dips or you can go to the farmer's market and get a couple of the salads and they'll function in there really, really well. But I think if you're wanting to impress, I would just try to get a lot of food on the table. It's really dazzling. It's really exciting. And the fun thing about entertaining too is that you can set it out before anybody arrives. And you know, right then when they walk in and they're invited over to the house, there's all this like fun food out on the table and just kind of gets everybody really excited.
In just our last few moments, we've got a lovely weekend coming up in most of Wisconsin. Then some 90 something degree days. Do you have a favorite hot weather combo?
Well, that gazpacho I mentioned is definitely one of my favorite hot weather foods because it's so quenching. But, you know, the other thing is just I really enjoy these crudités when these vegetables are in season and you can spend a minute just like, you know, cleaning them nicely and cutting them into fun shapes. In the book, I have a whole sort of tutorial on how to prep your crudités to make them really arresting visually. Some really cold, fresh vegetables and a couple dips, like nothing really beats that, to be honest.
Lucas, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much, Rob.
That's Lucas Vulgar, a writer and editor. He was with us sharing his new cookbook on this edition of Food Friday. The cookbook is called Snacks for Dinner, Small Bites, Full Plates, Can't Lose. You can find a few recipes that Lucas shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We've got a salad, we've got a dip, and then we've got a snack mix. Check them out at WPR.org/Food Friday. Maybe make them over the weekend. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, the Wisconsin Election Commission is at the center of complaints about the 2020 election and in the midst of getting ready for the 2022 midterms. The new chair of that commission, just appointed to that commission, joins the show. That's Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. If you've ever had cats, you might have given them some catnip and then seen them freak out, roll around in it, chew on it, generally have a good old time with the stuff. Looks like fun, and there may be an evolutionary reason for it. Mosquitoes. As reported on the Smithsonian website, researchers in Japan tested catnip and a related plant with cats and found it has some natural mosquito repellent chemicals in it. It repels mosquitoes a little bit when cats roll around in it, but when they chew it and lick it first, it damages the leaves, releases more of those chemicals in a more effective cocktail. So your classic cat freakout chewing and licking catnip then rolling around on it can be a decent mosquito repellent for cats. Now, how about us humans? Researchers say chemicals from catnip could be worth a try, but not if you're allergic to cats, because you're going to attract them while you repel the mosquitoes. Something to chew on. This is Central Time.